Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm here today to talk with David Hull about his new translation of Zheng Tianyi's The Pigeon Warrior. Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, Dave, and thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Carla.
So you are now a regular at the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. We've actually spoken before about your translation of Mao Dun's Waverings. So I'm not going to ask you the questions that I ask first timers because we've been there. We're beyond that. We've progressed. So instead, I'll ask you this, Dave, and I can, when this comes out, I can post the link to the previous one for listeners. What have you been up to since we last spoke for the podcast?
Well, for better or ill, a lot of my time has been in moving. I'm extraordinarily happy to announce that I am now on a beautiful position at Washington College here in Chestertown, Maryland.
Yay! Congratulations.
Thank you. The downside for productivity is, as you know, moving and getting established and rebuilding things takes a little bit of time. So, I've been doing small projects here and there, but mostly just getting established, building a new Chinese language program, all that good stuff.
Fabulous. And yes, I do absolutely sympathize. Listeners who don't know, I also recently moved to a new country, my old country, the U.S., the new house. And Dave has been getting updates from me all the time about my very, very old new house and all of its issues that we will not talk about anymore. What we will talk about is this fabulous book. So the book we're talking about today is another translation, and this is a translation of a novel that is set in 1930s Shanghai during wartime. So Dave, let's kind of get into it by talking about the genesis of the project. What brought you to this particular book as something that you wanted to translate?
Well, this is another one of the brilliant seeds that was planted in a seminar way back in graduate school. Ted Huter's, one of his classes, we read a little bit of Zheng Tianyi, and I was just really struck by his use of language. He has an amazing, Zheng Tianyi has this amazing facility with language, and in particular, he has this kind of magic of delivering accents and delivering unique voices in a way that is not overwhelming, like you'll sometimes find. Zheng Tianyi has a standard Baihua kind of voice, but his characters speak out in very clean ways. Obviously, the language is a challenge for a translator, but the other thing that really drew me is it's just funny. Zheng Tianyi has an amazing comic way of satirizing everything from slapstick to you know, fairly subtle commentary satire. And so after I finished Waverings, I was looking for another project. Luckily, one of the editors over at Blestier Press, who put out the book, I got in touch with him, and he said, "Oh my God, I remember this when I was a kid. I read this when I was young, and it's you know something that he found fabulous and had wonderful memories of." And so, you know, happily we came together over that.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. So we'll talk about that, but I will say for listeners who enjoy reading fiction, for anybody who knows anything about comic books or graphic novels, I actually put down the latest issues of Saga in order to read this. That's how enjoyable it was, is I chose The Pigeon Warrior over like the last major, like, whoa, how did that happen, issues of Saga. And so that should tell you that's how enjoyable
it is. High praise.
That is serious high praise. And I am totally serious when I say that. So you've mentioned, and we've both kind of talked a little bit about the fact that the novel is set in 1930s Shanghai, and there's some conflict going on. So for listeners who know like nothing about this, right, who haven't read the book yet, is there anything in particular that they should know about this context in order that you feel, right, in order to appreciate how Zhang is dealing with it in the book?
Well, if you're starting from zero, the critical thing for this period is the period in between dynastic China and the People's Republic of China. We call this the Republican era, more or less. But the critical context for this narrative is that the Japanese are invading, and sometimes this is a very critical, bloody part of the narrative. But for a lot of it, it's simply a narrative driver. It's in the background, and it's pushing several narrative threads, but it's not critical to the immediate story. It does hang over everything, though, and several mm-hmm. of the kind of the major themes and the major satiric pushes that Zhang is working with are directly related to the challenge to Chinese identity and the challenge to what does it mean. We deal with this issue a whole lot. What does it mean to be Chinese if China is conquered? Is there a Chinese identity that can move forward? And of course, a lot of other authors of the time are dealing with issues of concern. Is there something fundamentally, essentially in the Chinese character that means we cannot survive in this area of kind of social evolution? Is there something failing within us that means that we are fated to be destroyed by the Japanese? Other authors are dealing with that more explicitly, and we see Zhang is playing with some of those, but it's a little more. It's not necessarily 100% in the forefront of a lot of the narrative threads.
So we actually read this coming up all over the novel, right? And a lot of both the conversations among the characters and also the kind of inner monologue almost mm-hmm. that we get when we read about the protagonist, and we'll get to him in a moment, deal with these questions of national essence or ethnic yes. essence, right? In a way that they're frequently they'll be mentioning, oh, this is part of, XX's mm-hmm. code for Japan, right? XX's national essence, or this is our national essence or ethnic essence. Mm-hmm. And as a reader, you're reading them having these exchanges, and part of your brain is like, oh, haha, that's so funny. And then part of it's like, wait a minute, though, these are actually some pretty profound, serious issues and questions, right? That, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the characters in particular, one of the kind of corrupt kind of war profiteer kind of guys, Liu Zhao, that's his shtick. The idea that at one point he says they're eating sunflower seeds or something, and they talk about people from Suzhou, these seeds are from Suzhou, and people from Suzhou really know how to eat sunflower seeds. They just are amazing at it. And that's the ethnic essence of people from Suzhou. And it's put out there. I mean, clearly it's a joke. It's satirizing this idea of ethnic essentialism. But exactly like what you said, it's kind of a satiric time bomb. It's hilarious. Well, I think it's hilarious when it goes on like that. But then later on, when it says, "Oh yes, the ethnic essence of the Japanese people is, you know, to divide or to be divisive or things like that," and that's something much more like you might hear a human say, an actual person in this world. And so it's in some places the novel seems fairly quickly put together, not quite slapdash, but there are points like this when you see that Zhang is very carefully building his satiric punches, kind of drawing you into something that seems ludicrous, and then kind of bringing it back in a very a more powerful way. Obviously, as you mentioned, this is tied to the idea of whether or not Chinese people can survive, regardless of whether the Chinese nation can survive, whether the Chinese, the whatever it is that a Chinese is, can continue. And one last kind of tag on that, you mentioned the XX people. This is something that's very common. If you haven't read much fiction of this time, many proper nouns are just rendered as X. The Japanese have taken over X province, or like you say, the Japanese are simply called the XX people. And that's also something that just seems like a trope of the time. But it also starts to have a really kind of subtle impact on the reader in terms of removing humanity from the Japanese people in the novel, or the Japanese as an enemy, or the Japanese as an army. It's kind of subtle, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something I wanted to bring out.
And actually, and this might come up later on when we talk about some of the other characters, but this thread of a kind of satirical dehumanization that actually has a more a pretty profound point behind it, I think, is something that comes up over and over again. And we'll see that in at least a couple of the characters we talk about, I think. But let's talk a little bit about this figure, Zhang, right? He's the author. But in the book, and this also gives us a chance to really get into the flesh of the book now, we are introduced to Zhang Tianyi in the preface. So the novel is organized into a preface and 14 chapters for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers. And the preface, dated to 1936, opens in the most charming way. Here is the beginning of the preface, right? It says, "Big boys, the story in this little book is told for you." So I think it's for big girls too, right? And I'll just say that. But I mean, right from the first thing, oh, okay, yes, I'm a big girl and I like this story too. So the personality of this like author / narrator figure and what that means, right, we can talk about, emerges here, and it's really striking, and it's actually like a really awesome voice and voicing. So can you talk a little bit, Dave, about what's happening here in the preface and how you think about this voicing of this like author / narrator figure in terms of setting the stage for the book and what's to come?
Yeah, sure. I'm really glad you found the preface as kind of striking as I did. The amazing thing, he's obviously, this is, let me take a step back. So a lot of this novel is kind of a Don Quixote-esque kind of
story. Yes.
And so as Cervantes was looking at previous kind of adventure tales of that sort, Zhang is clearly building a false kung fu novel. You know, the kung fu genre is obviously ancient in China. And so he in this preface, he's starting out by basically playing with the idea that the reader is this person who naively saw this as a kung fu novel and picked it up and was going to read it just like another kung fu novel. But the kind of wonderful thing he does is he starts explaining how kung fu novels work. And first, after he says kind of derogatory things about D'Artagnan and how Western adventure novels are no good, he talks about how the trope of the kung fu novel, that there are these agents that are out in the country and they live, you know, they're rich and powerful, but they live in places where the emperor's reach isn't strong, where the policing isn't very strong. And whenever they run into trouble, they invent these heroic swordsmen and kung fu warriors. And these kung fu warriors magically will show up, fix all of your problems, and then leave without even asking for payment. And the kind of the wonderful thing that he's doing there is he's making the argument that these kung fu novels are specifically built to support the status quo, the people in positions of power. And so all of these great stories that you've read your entire life, they're nothing but kind of imaginative tools to get you to believe the morality and the system of ethics that these agents have. So you've got the emperor with his system, and you've got these local agents, the landlords and people like this. And all of these stories that you may love to read are nothing more than tools to kind of reinforce that that social hierarchy. And obviously, Zhang Tianyi is a leftist and certainly of the time. But it's kind of a nice way of threading that argument into what is otherwise a fairly politically even-handed novel.
That's fabulous. And we'll see, I think, definitely later on in the novel as we get into it, and perhaps later on in our conversation, this idea of types of morality, right? The new morality, other kinds, also comes up in the context of the relationship between the characters and how they're trying to understand each other and figure each other out. And we'll get to that when we get especially to Miss He. And we'll get there in a minute. But before we get there, let's get to the protagonist. So in the preface, Zhang, this kind of narrator, author, voicing that he gives us, he says, "This little book might be said to provide a how-to guide to becoming a swordsman." Okay, so that's supposed to happen ostensibly through this figure that we meet right at the beginning. This is the protagonist, Shi Zhaochang. So he is hilarious. We follow him through the entire book. What do listeners need to know about this figure right at the beginning? Can you tell us a little bit about what you think is particularly interesting about
Sure. Well, I will say the quote that you mentioned that I love so much, that this is a book that could teach you how to be a swordsman. He follows that up by saying it's equally as useful as those how to be a writer books, which I think is the kind of the ba-doom boom kind of punchline of that. But Shi Zhaochang, he is, as I mentioned before, he's kind of a Don Quixote figure. He has read far too many kung fu novels and bought into the entirety of it. For the narrative sake, he lived up north in Beijing. And when the Japanese were coming in, he's fleeing with his family south to Shanghai. And his hope is that he will be able to find a kung fu master under whom he can study and become this kind of stereotypical kung fu warrior, so that he can kick the Japanese out of China, take over basically all of Asia. And then at one point he says, you know, he wants to beat all of these other countries and conquer all of these countries. And he says, and then the U.S., well, the United States has kind of been our friend, so I'll let that decision till later whether or not he wants to take over the United States as well.
That's right. So we follow him. So we're getting to know him in the first couple of chapters. In the second chapter, he decides, yeah, I've got to be a hero, right? So we see him kind of coming to this decision. I'm going to be a hero. He says on page 34, to be a hero, one must believe in oneself. One must train tirelessly. One must establish great ambitions. And one of his ambitions turns out to be to find a woman partner that he can kind of be heroes with, right? So we meet this character who's going to potentially be that for him, his sort of woman warrior of national salvation, right? This is what this figure that this woman we're going to meet kind of fits, right? So this woman warrior of national salvation turns out to be this character, Miss He, and he meets her when we meet her in chapter 3. Can you say a little bit about Miss He? Who is she and what's she doing here? Because she is honestly like one of the most striking characters in this book,
it's,
right?
She's pretty awesome. I shouldn't have favorites, but she is probably my favorite. She is fascinating for a billion different reasons. And what her fundamental identity is a misunderstanding. She comes into the Shi household looking for donations and subscriptions to her patriotic song and dance troupe. She basically runs a burlesque house, and she has been rolling with the times. Another thing we see throughout the novel is everyone is finding a way to make money or survive based on the idea of marketing save the nation. So no matter what you're selling or what you're trying to do, all you have to do is tag save the nation onto it and it sells better. So she's turned this burlesque house into a patriotic song and dance troupe. And so she comes in and she is... Zhang gives us these wonderful kind of partial descriptions of people, and she is described in kind of fleeting glimpses, but she is a, let's say, past her prime, perhaps, very heavily made up, very tightly permed hair. She's hyper conscious of her physicality. She's always looking to see how she's standing and how she's posing. But she's a burlesque dancer. When our protagonist Shi Zhaochang hears her or sees her come in, she mentions that one of the musicals that she's performing is this, you know, woman warrior of national salvation. And Shi Zhaochang immediately assumes that she is also a kung fu warrior. She is, she has learned all of these skills. She's a fighter. She's just like the women in the old kung fu novels. The one he always references is this character called 13th Sister. And so he's always looking for his 13th Sister. And so the thing that clinches it, the things that he's totally convinced that she's a warrior, is when she leaves the house, she blows him a kiss. And he's terrified because he thinks this is some kind of secret blade-spitting technique, that this is some kind of an attack. And Shi Zhaochang's little brother hits him with a pebble, a little mud pellet. And Shi Zhaochang is convinced that this was her showing off her skill, that, you know, she is shown how much more skilled she is than he is. So he falls in love/lust, but also it's this ideological thing. He knows he needs this partner to help subdue the demons and the devils of the world. And all she's interested in is, you know, getting money for ticket sales. And also she's what might charitably be called a taxi dancer. She gets paid by the kiss, let's say.
That's right. And she's, and so just a couple of things that are just came up in what you said that are just, that I just have to comment on. So first of all, this little brother, the little brother figure, he's a total jerk, right? He's this little obnoxious, awful little boy who's not so little, but he's like the big hope of the family, right? Because they went to a fortune teller at some point, apparently, who said he's going to be like head of, some unit or some kind of commander by the time he's 16. So everyone's like walking on eggshells around him. Meanwhile, he's like punching people and hitting people and like, yes, throwing a little like mud clot at his brother and eventually, as we'll see in a minute, at this Miss Hutt, right? So he's a total jerk, but like it's so great whenever he comes up in the story because it's so funny to read about what a jerk he is.
Let me break in there, though, because another wonderful thing that's going on there that – and maybe this is where you're going, but this is the faith that the entire family has – well, except for Sir Zhao Tong – the faith that they have in him because this fortune teller has said he's going to be a division commander is crippling this child. They have faith that he's going to be an army commander and do all of this. So we've got to you know walk on eggshells, like you say. But it's parallel and equal to Sir Zhao Chang's faith in his kung fu skills and you know Chinese civilization broadly. And everyone in the entire novel has some kind of faith in something that is fundamentally hollow.
Yes, yes. And also everyone in the novel is not necessarily entirely good or entirely bad, right? And so this is exactly where I wanted to go. I mean, so you've already, I think, really, really nicely brought up how that plays out in terms of the little brother. But even in terms of Miss He, right? I mean, she's, you know, I'll ask you a little bit about what it was like to translate her speech in a moment, right? Because this is really marked. But since this is coming up now, she's almost kind of – you read her and it's easy for – I guess at least for me as a reader to kind of read her as sort of a caricature until, right, you get to this point on page 147 and 148. And I just want to like read this really,
yes, please.
Really
I know what you're going for. This is
okay?
I'm glad you're going this direction. That's what I was
You know what I'm going for, right? This – okay. Okay, awesome. Because this like broke my heart, right? Okay, so she's really lighthearted up to this point. She's got these speech patterns we'll talk about that are kind of funny. She's marked as this sort of ridiculous figure. And then the little brother throws this sardine can that's still got like fish oil at her face, right? And she goes and she washes her face. And she's at this point, she's with and she's kind of in his bathroom. So the other one was scrubbing this. The other one is Miss He. This is the end of 147. The other one was scrubbing with foreign soap and a will. Now we can see her original appearance. A color, like Shijiawu, similar to a rotten Buddha hand fruit, in some areas greenish, wrinkles popped up like a dried out orange peel, lips blackened, spots large and small covered her face, there were no eyebrows. Every day when she washed her face, she was a little uncomfortable. Old La, like a sick person La, like a dead person, La. Have to put on rouge, add some eyebrows, and keep up appearances, La. She felt that she was nearly dead. But every week she had to go to the stores and buy all these things to build herself into something like a young, vivacious girl. And it goes on. This was such a moving part of... So Dave, I'll just kind of throw the ball over to you. Can you talk a little bit about this character, this moment, and what it's like to translate her?
Like I say, I'm very happy you went to that quote because I think that is one of the things that Zhang Tianyi, and he's uneven, the author is uneven about this in some ways, but he has an incredible humane touch in places that you wouldn't expect. And I think that's the best example in this book, because again, she is this comic, you know, she's like Great Gatsby on acid. She's a flapper character. And then the time frame is about right for flappers. So that's kind of a nice frame for her. But she is brought down so human in that point that it is kind of heartbreaking. There's another example when one of the con men who are trying to con Shijia Tang out of his money. He realizes that he's going to have money soon, and he has this moment where he thinks that he might rebuild this temple. That it would be a good thing that he could use his money to rebuild this temple. And he's been a horrible character through the entire novel. But then there's this moment where he kind of has this nice little touch of humaneness in there. And I think it's very difficult for slapstick comedy to drop into that kind of nice clarity. And she's a great character. And we can talk about, you know, how her speech works, or we can talk about her morality, or I'll let you guide where you think we should go.
Yeah. Well, so one of the, let's talk about both of them. Let's talk about the speech first, just in terms of a translator, right? So listeners may have heard me when I just was reading that say, you know, something, something, la. And so her speech, I'll put it this way, is very distinctive. And that la, right, at the end of the sentences is part of her voicing in the novel. So what was happening?
Again, as I said earlier, Zhang Tianyi has a wonderful pen for accents and speeches, mannerisms. And Miss He is supposed to be kind of the perfect melding of the modern for Chinese people in Shanghai. And so she is presented as a Shanghainese person, but that doesn't mean that she's necessarily from Shanghai, because nobody's from Shanghai, right? Everybody comes to Shanghai. It's like New York. Mm-hmm. And so she has this la and many other affectations that I didn't translate. In fact, there was one other in the quote you mentioned. She says, it's like I'm dead. It's like I'm dead, and she,
right.
the characters are phonetically off. But if you kind of read it out loud, you can kind of see where she's going in the original. And so, not to get into too much of the technicality of it, what I wanted to push with her is that she is fundamentally of a different class, of a different place, of a different time than anybody else in the novel. And I did kind of go with a flapper, a mod girl kind of a voice for her. But it's important that in every conversation that people have with her, there's a slight disjointedness. You can tell the other characters can't really understand her completely, but yet the English has to be clear enough for the readers to understand. She has another affectation and with the la, I was actually, the text helps out, because there's one point in the text where I think it's Shijia Chang actually says, why does she keep saying la all the time? Is that Shanghainese? Is that another language? And the character he asks says, I don't know. I don't know what it is either. So you're kind of drawn in. You're just as confused as the characters in the story are. She has another affectation, which is kind of more to the modernism and kind of globalized, internationalized point. There obviously is a word in Chinese for Mr. And one of our characters is called Mr. Liu Liu. But for Miss He, she will say that. She will say Xianzhang, but she will also say Mi Se Tuo and Mi Se Se. As phonetic loans for Mr. and Mrs. And again, it's very it brings you up short when you're reading it in Chinese and in English. And so I wanted to make sure and bring that across. And again, the text helps because I think near the end, there's a Mr. Tuo, and Ms. He calls him Mr. Tuo.
Wait, Dave, I think we just lost you
okay.
Right after
I'll
you
jump
said
back. near the end of the novel,
yes.
there's a character called Mr. Tuo, and Miss He calls him Mr. Tuo or Miss Tuo Tuo, yeah. And Shi Zhao Chang doesn't know what that means, and so he flubs it whenever he tries to figure out who this Mr. Tuo is. And I think I ended up putting it in English as missed something, like you missed something. And so the language throughout the translation, and there's some other things we can talk about, but the language seems again kind of slapdash, but he Zhang Tianyi does a very careful job of weaving what he thinks is important later on into the narrative, so that the long-term jokes that he's planting almost always have a punchline.
So I'll definitely bring us back to Ms. He and some of the issues. But since you've already brought it up, right, when you mentioned there's some other stuff that we could talk about, what are some examples? Because I was going to ask you a little bit later anyway about, you know, like some of the aspects of the language or the voicing of the text that were particularly challenging.
Well, there's for you. So the other one I was thinking of in particular is there's a character who his name is Half Moat, which is again another callback. There's a famous character in I forget which kung fu novel, but there's a famous kung fu novel character called Moat of Sand or Moat Grain of Sand. And so this guy, he isn't even a grain, he's a half moat. But he comes from I think Changsha or somewhere, and he has a very thick accent, and again, it's brought up in conversation as being incomprehensible to Shi Zhao Chang. And again, the technical parts of the translation are interesting, maybe, but I think the narrative pushes is more important here because, again, this is Shanghai. This is the title of the novel, The Pigeon Warrior. It's referring to this pigeon language that everybody ends up speaking when you come to a metropolis like Shanghai. And so the idea that people who are nominally Chinese can't understand each other is fundamental to the broader themes of the novel. What does it mean? You know, can a Chinese person be a Chinese person when they're not around Chinese people, or when Chinese people come together? What is the commonality that makes all of us Chinese? All of these questions. And for several of these characters, I think Ms. He, in terms of kind of the globalized modern international world, but also this half moat in terms of even Chinese people who have no foreignness about them are foreign. And I think that's a maybe it's not particularly unique or new, but I think it's a fairly clever way of bringing that through comically.
And this issue of comprehensibility, right? Mutual comprehensibility, but also the issue of pigeon, right? This kind of mixture, this state of being both at the same time brings us, I think, really nicely back to another aspect of Ms. He's, or the discussion about Ms. He that also comes up later, and that seems to me to be a major emergent theme of the book. This is the relationship between kind of good and evil, right? This is another kind of call it related to a kind of pigeon, right? When we're meeting Miss He, right, in chapter 3, I think it is, that there's a question, was she actually evil or not? And this comes up over and over again as like the issue of how to fit her into morality, into what might be a new morality, what that means, is something that the protagonist is struggling with. And the question recurs again in chapter 12. We have the question, who are the evil ones and who are the good ones? And this is in the context of a discussion among the characters where these Japanese monks have just been beaten and they're trying to figure out, like, well, they're Japanese and we're supposed to hate them, right? So does that mean it's good that they were beat, or is it bad because they're monks and you're not supposed to beat monks? And so this, it's funny, but at the same time, it's bringing up this much deeper issue of good and bad, but both at the same time, and this tension here. So would you talk a little bit about
that?
Sure.
Yeah, the fundamental – so let me sidestep a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
One of the things that makes this novel, in my opinion, kind of fun to translate is that it works through a free indirect speech point of view, meaning that there is a narrator, but as we talked about in the preface, it's not sure the narrator is the author, and it's the narrator is not one of the characters, but the narrator flows from character to character in different ways. Most of the time, the narration runs through Shi Zhaochang's mind, and so we see direct quotes, Shi Zhaochang talking to himself, but also quotes of Shi Zhaochang talking to himself or thinking about something, you know, as narrative voice. What that's important for here, in my opinion, is that Shi Zhaochang has learned morality and he knows what is, he believes he knows what is true and what is good, and that is Chinese culture, Chinese history. The more Chinese you are, the more true you are, the more correct you are. The problem is his understanding of what that means is shaky. His father, one of the standard examples, pardon me one sec. One of the examples that's used in the novel is this idea of a splay foot culture. His father has taught him you have to stand like a hero. And so to stand like a hero means to stand like a stereotypical opera character on stage. So you have your feet, kind of duck feet out, and you stand with this very artificial way. Your eyes are pulled up in strange ways, and you don't breathe with your lungs. There's all these things that you have to do to stand properly. So he knows what is – he's confident. He knows what is true and good and right, but – he believes that is Chineseness, but it's not. It's an artificial representation of Chineseness. It's an artificial representation of culture and truth and correctness. So he has, I would say, he has no interest in what the real Guanyu actually did, but the mythical Guanyu, the Guanyu of stage and novels. He will model his life on that. And so when we get to someone like Miss He, he's baffled because he believes she is this woman warrior of national salvation. That's good. But she is also this, you know, burlesque taxi dancer. And in one of the really good scenes in there, Miss He is there in backstage with all of her other burlesque dancers and everything, and she starts going on about what modern morality means, and it's I wish I had the quote here, but it's all about, you know, some boys want to, you know, put grease in their hair and go look out for a rich woman, and some women want to look for a whole bunch of men, and you know, the all of this very libertine kind of, you know, Chicago movie style or musical style kind of morality. And that's clearly bad. That's clearly evil. But also he lusts for her. And that's, you know, a fairly standard trope in these kind of things, but he's looking for anything that will tell him how to move forward. He's looking for a guideline of some kind.
And he's like also a dude who's lonely, you know, and in terms of the humanizing elements of this, it, as he's lusting after her and he's like trying to come up with some way to I think reconcile these worries he has about her, because as much as he's worried about this kind of new morality, whether this is good or evil, should he be okay with this or not, he's constantly justifying to himself why things are okay. And you can see this thread of he's lonely, he wants a companion, you know, like he's trying to do what a lot of us do often, is he's sort of making these rose-colored glasses for himself that he can look through because he really wants to be with her, you know? And so there's for me as a reader, there's this very sympathetic undercurrent where there's a pathos there, right? Where we see him clearly as a human who's trying to live just like any of us humans are trying to do, at the same time as he's trying to become a superhero.
And that's a brilliant point, because one of the things that I really like about this is how frankly modern it seems. Now he has found an ideology, he has found a truth, and he can't change that because he knows what is true and what is good and what is right. But what he's doing is he's trying to maneuver his actual world so that it will fit in the ideology. Rather than rebuilding his worldview, he has to find a way that wanting to be with this woman fits within the categories of good and right. And that's just one of the things where this book actually reads kind of very current in a certain way. The idea of, you know, the fraudulent nature of kind of hyper nationalism and the corrupt way of digging for money based on other people's authentic kind of goodwill and things like this. There's a lot of in this book, there's a lot of very stringent criticism of things today.
That's right. Absolutely. absolutely. And there's this sense also that, and you know, you've talked already really beautifully about this. He wants to be a hero, right? And he's trying to be, he's got these models from this idealized past, and he's trying to come to terms with what it is in his version of now, right, to be a hero. And so you'll see him integrating not just these poses, right, that he thinks are classic, and not just these ideas of a kind of classical, essential Chinese past or Chinese essence, but you'll also see him looking at the posters on a wall and seeing people who are dressed in bathing suits, and it becomes this idea of a stealth suit. So he's like describing the people in this poster on the wall who are in bathing suits, and he's like, I don't really know what's going on there. It must be a stealth suit. And it becomes this idea of like what a superhero costume is, right? So he's like looking for a stealth suit so he can really be dressed like a superhero. It's just this wonderful amalgamation and this kind of state of unrest, right, and tumult, where he's trying to create an idea of what it is to live now while everything is changing and everything is not,
absolutely,
unsure.
And the idea, just to kind of put a coat on that piece of it, one of the other things that he's looking at facades to get his understanding of what Chinese culture should be, but his representation of Chinese culture is also very facade based. So he wants to be like the hero Guan Yu. Therefore, he's not going to do the things that Guan Yu did. He's going to try to do his best to look like Guan Yu. And so it's another one of these kind of layers of the satire, that it's the presentation and it's the facade. The other example that comes to mind is Mr. Liu Liu, who is another one of these kind of upper level con men, he leads the hunger strike of the elite, I think is the name of the group. And his what he says is, "I will not eat." But in Chinese, that's "我不要吃饭." Like, I'm not going to eat rice. And so when he says, "I'm not going to eat," he still eats soup and he eats all of this other, anything that doesn't have rice in it, he'll eat it. But it's still considered a hunger strike because he doesn't eat rice. And so again, it's this very legalistic kind of facade of nationalistic honor. But it's so shallow.
And you've mentioned already, right? I mean, the way that nationalism and a kind of concern with national essence or ethnic essence pervades the book. And we've talked about also the way a concern with morality pervades the book. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording about the ways for you that these are related to a larger concern yeah. with rules. And following rules. Did you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's
yeah, like sure. Really and this kind of tags on with you know with Shi Zhaochang looking for you know the guidelines. You know how to walk. If I walk this way, the people who were moral walked this way. Therefore, if I walk this way, I will be moral. But it's not just with him, obviously. And again, going back to our favorite Miss He. There are several times, the one I'm thinking of right now, she's in Shi Zhaochang's lap and going to kiss him. But according to the rules, she thinks, well, he has to kiss me. I can't kiss him. But then she remembers there was a movie. There was a Western movie where the girl kissed the guy. And then she goes, okay, well, I guess it's okay. And so she kisses him. And so it's this wonderful passivity, this idea that, well, I need to find the previous models, and obviously if it happened in a movie, then that means it's something that happens. So I can do that. And everyone in the entire novel is looking for these guidelines. And I think that speaks more broadly to the kind of where we started some of this conversation, the idea that how do you be Chinese in this new world that doesn't look like the China, you know? Do you go back to the ancient guidelines like Shi Zhaochang thinks that he's doing, or do you go to the modern guidelines that Miss He thinks that she's going for, or the corporate guidelines that Mr. Liu Liu thinks he's going for? There's everybody is looking to be led in a certain way.
Right. So if you can believe it, Dave, we are actually coming to the conclusion of our conversation. I know. There is so much more I want to be asking you about. There's just a couple of things that I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about yeah. if it's something that you want to talk about. And before we move to our conclusion, and one of them is something that we've kind of skirted around or talked with this whole hour, but we haven't really zeroed in on it as a problematic for you as a translator, and that's the importance of humor and satire in the language. So you've talked, right, you've talked a bit already about your approach to and the challenges of mm-hmm. translating different kinds of voice here, right? Ms. He or the narrator. But is there anything else that you felt strongly about that might speak to your experience translating humor and satire specifically?
Well, in the case of this novel? Yes. It's a doomed game, really. There are some times when you translate, and you've done translation. Everybody, you know, most of the people who are listening to this have probably done some translation. And there's points at which you know the felicitous, the muse of translation comes down, and the right words appear. But with humor, it's triple hard because For example, for Zhang Tianyi, he loves puns and he loves wordplay. And in some cases, I footnoted that there's a pun on a calligrapher, a classical calligrapher. They misread his name, and it's a pun about saying the calligraphy is shit. it's a very nice kind of subtle joke, but that's something I wasn't able to bring out in the translation. This every translator has their own kind of way of trying to handle this. My general rule is, if there is comedy in the original, you want to try to bring comedy out in the translation. That might not be exactly where and how it came out in the original. Another example I'm thinking of is when Miss He is when they're going over accounts for how much money Miss He has gotten from Shi Zhao Chang. She says, I wish I could remember the original, but the English is, I K'd your S 5 times. And that's not the joke in the original. That's not the precise joke in the original, but it's breaking up. It was breaking up of an original compound in the original and playing with a 2-character compound and having something inside that 2-character compound. And so I found a way to hopefully make that at least partially funny, but also give the reader an idea of the play that's going on in the original. Most of them don't come out in that way, but it's a losing game, but you do what you can.
So Dave, we've talked a little bit over the course of our conversation about some of our favorite characters and some of the moments associated with them. As we come to our close, are there any other kind of moments for you or chapters or characters that you would particularly want to direct listeners to that are particular favorites, either as a reader, right, of the text or as a translator?
To be fair, the end of the novel doesn't wrap up perhaps as well as you might hope, but there is one at the very end of the novel. Shi Zhao Chang kind of goes into this, he hasn't been sleeping for days, and he goes into kind of this hallucination where he starts killing all these Japanese people, and he kills the Japanese army all the way into finding the Japanese emperor, and the Japanese emperor has to bow to him, and the supreme ultimate master is kind of this Buddha-like figure floating up on a cloud. And it's again, talking about making him human, it by showing his most desperate desires and then bring him back to the war-torn streets of Shanghai. It's again, it's one of those clever things where he gives you something that is on its surface ludicrous and silly and hopefully again kind of funny, but then bringing you back. And you know, soon after that he gets shot in the shoulder, and it's just a The main character is very funny, but he is also desperately sad, and I think that's kind of a powerful moment.
Absolutely, thank you, so much. I wanted to I wanted to make sure that we got to that moment actually, and so yay. So Dave, now that we have somehow right come to the end of our hour, and we really honestly
on
could
just
talk
this whole, we could go on
for way longer about this, but I know. We didn't even talk about the supreme ultimate master. We didn't talk about like the noodles that much. We didn't talk. There's so much more. And so listeners, definitely read the book because there's a lot we didn't talk about. But in the for the moment, Dave, is there anything in particular that didn't come up in this hour, but that you'd especially
I think
like to mention?
The supreme ultimate master is the other one that was kind of on my list, but I think we can basically just leave it as he is another one of these con men who is also kind of sad at his core. He gets exposed in a really humiliating way by Zhao Wu, by the younger brother, and it's pathetic in the original meaning of the word. I think that's kind of pointed.
Dave, we just lost you after just for a moment.
Sure.
Can you just say that one more time?
The Supreme Ultimate Master is another kind of fun character, but also in kind of the trend, he's a con man. He's a kind of a joke, but he's also desperately sad as well. He gets exposed in a really humiliating way by the younger brother, the protagonist, and so. He's another character worth taking a closer read at.
Right. Thank you so much. And that moment, that's another moment as a reader that I think you translated really powerfully, in that reading, you have this guy who's kind of a comic figure. Every hero needs their master, right? And so, like, this is going to be our protagonist master. And you see him kind of bumbling along, obviously lying, but then that moment where they're all eating together and they put him on the spot, and it's something like, well, we should be able to see you flash an aura or something, right? So do it now, like, show us your superpowers now. And just the panic that you can feel coming from him. And again, it's this moment of extreme pathos that you've translated for us.
It comes from the kids. I mean, Zhao Wu, again, this really kind of horrible younger brother, but also fourth sister, the youngest daughter, is also just calling him these horrible names. And so it's bringing him low in a way that doesn't feel triumphant at all.
No, I know. And the sister's calling him these names by basically just repeating what the brother's saying. And so you can also see, like, the seeds of, you can kind of see the seeds of something that potentially has just really profound consequences. Speaking of things that are relevant to us.
Everyone's
right now
looking for rules.
Exactly. So, Dave, now that the book is out, and congratulations, it's amazing. I can't wait to teach with it, as is the case for all of your translations that I have. What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm kind of doing a shift onto a little more research-oriented stuff. I'd like to at the bare minimum, I'd like to do an article on satire in Zhang Tianyi's novels broadly. I think there's room also for a monograph of Republican-era satire. There's a lot of political teleology in the research of the time, assuming that everyone has to have a political motive, and there must be, even with Lu Xun, there has to be, it's politics first. I think there's a lot more to be said in that area. And I think it was I forget the title of his book, but Chris Ray put out a book on humor that I would like to, I'd like to build on in satire.
Awesome. Well, best of luck with that, Dave. And thank you so much for taking time away from that and from your settling into your new place to talk about this. It's an amazing translation and a really powerful and moving one. So thank you very much.